curious, wary expression on her face as she looked at him through the truck's open passenger door. Not getting in right away, wide blue eyes checking him out first, trying to decide if he was the kind of guy who might bite or maybe try to yank something off her. An ear, for instance. "Are you a nice person?" she'd asked him, and he had said, "Yeah, I guess so." And then, nice person that he was, he had brought her to this town of the dead, and his hand was in her crotch, and he was thinking he'd like to fuck her and hurt her at the same time. Kind of an experiment, you could say, one having to do with pleasure and pain, the sweet and the salty. Because that was the way it was done in the place of the wolf. That was how it was done in the house of the scorpion. It was what passed for love and desperation. "Are you a nice person? Not a crazy serial killer or anything? Are you nice? Are you nice? Are you a nice person?" He pulled his hand away from her, shuddering. He turned to the window and looked out into the blowing blackness where sand danced like snow. He could feel sweat on his chest and arms and in his armpits, and although it was a little better now, he still felt like a sick man between fits of delirium. Now that he had thought of the stone wolf, he couldn't unthink it seemed. He kept seeing its crazy corkscrewed head and bulging eyes. It hung in his head like an unsatisfied habit. "What's wrong?" she moaned from beside him. "Oh, Jesus, Steve, I didn't mean to do that. What's wrong with us?"
"I don't know," he said hoarsely. "But I'll tell you something I do know. We just got us a little taste of what happened in this town, and I don't like it much. I can't get that fucking stone thing out of my mind."
He finally found enough courage to look at her. She was all the way over against the passenger door, like a scared teenager on a first date that had gone too far. And although she looked calm enough, her cheeks were fiery red, and she was wiping away tears with the side of her hand. "Me either," she said. "I remember once I got a little piece of glass in my eye. That's what this feels like. I keep thinking I'd like to take that stone and rub it against my... you know. Except it's not much like thinking. It's not like thinking at all."
"I know," he said, wishing savagely that she hadn't said that.
Because now the idea was in his mind, too. He saw himself rubbing that ugly damn thing, ugly but powerful, against his erect penis. And from there he saw the two of them fucking on the floor beneath that row of hooks, beneath those dangling corpses, with that crumbling gray piece of stone held between them, in their teeth. Steve swept the images away, although how long he would be able to keep them away he didn't know. He looked at her again and managed to smile.
"Don't call me Cookie," he said. "Don't call me Cookie, and I won't call you Cake."
She let out a long, trembling, half-vocalized breath that fell just a little short of laughter. "Yeah, something like that anyway. I think it might be getting a little better." He nodded cautiously. Yes, he still had a world-class hard-on, and he could badly use a reprieve from that. But now his thoughts seemed a little more his own. If he could keep them diverted from that piece of stone a little while longer, he thought he'd be okay. But for a few seconds there it had been bad, maybe the worst thing that had ever happened to him. In those seconds, he had known how guys like Ted Bundy must feel. He could have killed her, maybe would have killed her, if he hadn't broken his physical contact with her when he had. Or, he supposed, she might have killed him. It was as if sex and murder had somehow changed places in this horrible little town. Except even sex wasn't what it was about, not really. He remembered how, when she had touched the wolf, the lights had flickered and the radio had come back on.
"Not sex," he said. "Not murder either. Power."
"Huh?"
"Nothing. I'm going to drive us right back through the middle of town, out toward the mine."
"That big wall off to the south?" He nodded.
"It's an open pit. There'll have to be at least one equipment road out there that cuts back to 50. We're going to find it and take it. I'm actually glad this one's blocked off. I don't want to go anywhere near that Quonset or that..."
She reached out and grabbed his arm. Steve followed her gaze and saw something come slinking into the arc of the truck's headlights. The dust was now so thick that at first the animal looked like a ghost, some Indian conjured spirit from 100 years ago. It was a timber wolf, easily the length and height of a German shepherd, but leaner. Its eyes were sockets of crimson in the headlights. Following it, like attendants in some malign fairy tale, were two files of desert scorpions with their stingers furled over their backs. Flanking the scorpions were coyotes, two on each side. They appeared to be grinning nervously. The wind gusted. The truck rocked on its springs. To their left, the fallen piece of awning flapped like a torn sail.
"The wolf's carrying something," she said hoarsely.
"You're nuts," he said, but as it drew closer, he saw that she wasn't nuts. The wolf stopped about 20 feet from the truck, as bald and real as something in a high-resolution crime scene photograph. Then it lowered its head and dropped the thing it had been holding in its mouth. It looked at it attentively for a moment, then backed off 3 steps. It sat down and began to pant. It was the statue fragment, lying there on its side at the entrance to the cafe parking lot, lying there in the blowing dust, mouth snarling, head twisted, eyes starting from their sockets. Fury, rage, sex, power, it seemed to broadcast these things at the truck in a tight cone, like some sort of magnetic field. The image of fucking Cynthia recurred, of being buried in her like a sword jammed hilt deep in hot, packed mud, the two of them face to face, lips drawn back in identical snarls as they gripped the snarling stone coyote between them like a thong.
"Should I get it?" she asked, and now she was the one who sounded as if she were sleeping.
"Are you kidding?" he asked. His voice, his Texas accent, but not his words, not now. These words were coming from the radio in his head, the one the piece of stone statue had turned on. Its eyes, glaring at him from where it lay in the dust.
"What then?"
He looked at her and grinned. The expression felt ghastly on his face. It also felt wonderful. "We'll get it together, of course. Okay by you?" His mind was the storm now, filled with roaring wind from side to side and top to bottom, driving before it the images of what he would do to her, what she would do to him, and what they would do to anyone who got in their way. She grinned back, her thin cheek stretching upward until it was like looking at a skull grin. Greenish-white light from the dashboard painted her brow and lips, filled in her eye sockets. She stuck her tongue out through that grin and flicked it at him, like the snake tongue of the statue. He stuck his own tongue out and wriggled it back at her. Then he groped for the door handle. He would race her to the fragment, and they would make love among the scorpions with it held in their mouths between them, and whatever happened after that wouldn't matter. Because in a very real sense, they would be gone. 3. Johnny came back out onto the sidewalk and handed the bottle of Jim Beam to Billingsley, who looked at it with the unbelieving eyes of a man who has just been told he's won the Powerball lottery. "There you go, Tom," he said. "Have yourself a tonk. Just the one, mind you, and then pass it on. None for me. I've taken the pledge." He looked across the street, expecting to see more coyotes, but there were still just the 5 of them. "I'll take the 5th, Johnny thought, watching as the veterinarian spun the cap off the bottle of whiskey. "You'd go along with that, wouldn't you, Tom?" "Of course you would."
"What is wrong with you?" Mary asked him. "Just what in the hell is wrong with you?"
"Nothing," Johnny said. "Well, a broken nose, but I guess that isn't what you mean, is it?"
Billingsley tilted the bottle back with a short, sharp flick of the wrist that looked as practiced as a nurse's injection technique, and then coughed.
Tears welled in his eyes. He put the mouth of the bottle to his lips again, and Johnny snatched it away.
"Nope, I don't think so, old-timer."
He offered the bottle to Ralph, who took it, looked at it, then bit off a quick swallow. Ralph then offered it to Mary.
"No."
"Go on," Ralph said. His voice was quiet, almost humble. "Better if you do." She looked at Johnny with hateful, perplexed eyes, then took a nip from the bottle. She coughed, holding it away from her and looking at it as if it were toxic. Ralph took it back, plucked the cap from Billingsley's left hand, and put it back on. During this, Johnny opened the bottle of aspirin, shook out half a dozen, bounced them in his hand for a moment, then tossed them into his mouth. "Come on, Doc," he said to Billingsley. "Lead the way." They started down the street, Johnny telling them as they went why he had all but broken his neck to get his cellular phone back. The coyotes on the other side of the street got up and paced them. Johnny didn't care for that much, but what were they supposed to do about it? Try shooting at them? Pretty noisy. At least there was no sign of the cop, and if they saw him before they made it down to the movie theater, they could always duck into one of these other places. Any old port in a storm. He swallowed, grimacing at the burn as the half-liquefied aspirin slid down his throat, and tried to put the bottle into his breast pocket. It bumped the top of the phone. He took it out, put the bottle of pills in its place, started to shove the cellular into his pants pocket, then decided it couldn't hurt to try again. He pulled the antenna and flipped the phone open. Still no transmission bars. Zilch.
"You really think that was your friend?" David asked.
"I think so, yes."
David held out his hand. "Could I try it?"
Something in his voice. His father heard it, too. Johnny could see it in the way the man was looking at him.
"David, son, is something wrong? Could I try it, please?"
"Sure, if you want." He held the useless phone out to the boy, and as David took it, Johnny saw three transmission bars appear beside the S. Not one or two, but three.
"Son of a bitch," he breathed, and grabbed the phone back.
David, who had been studying the keypad functions, saw him reaching a moment too late to stop him. The moment the cellular phone was back in Johnny's hand, the transmission bars disappeared again, leaving only the S.
"They were never there in the first place. You know that, don't you? You hallucinated them. You..."
"Give it back!" David shouted. Johnny was stunned by the anger in his voice. The phone was snatched away again, but not too fast for him to see the transmission bars reappear, glowing gold in the dark.
"This is so damn dumb," Mary said, looking first back over her shoulder, then at the coyotes across the street. They had stopped when the people had.
"But if it's the way you want to play it, why don't we just drag a table out and get drunk in the middle of the fucking street?"
No one paid any attention. Billingsley was still looking at the bottle of Beam. Johnny and Ralph were staring at the kid, who was stuttering his finger on the name/menu button with the speed of a veteran video game player, hurrying past Johnny's agent and ex-wife and editor, finally getting to Steve.
"David, what is it?" Ralph asked. David ignored him and turned urgently to Johnny. "Is this him, Mr. Marinville? Is the guy with the truck Steve?"
"Yes."
David pushed send. 4. Steve had heard of being saved by the bell, but this was ridiculous. Just as his fingers found the door handle, and he could hear Cynthia grabbing for hers on the other end of the seat, the cellular telephone gave out its nasal, demanding cry.
"Meep! Meep!"
Steve froze. Looked at the phone, looked across the seat at Cynthia, whose door was actually open a little. She was staring back at him, the grin on her lips fading.
"Meep, meep."
"Well," she asked, "aren't you going to answer that?" And there was something in her tone, something so wifely, that he laughed. Outside, the wolf pointed its nose into the darkness and howled, as if it had heard Steve's laughter and disapproved. The coyote seemed to take that howl as a signal. They got up and disappeared back the way they had come, walking into the blowing dust with their heads lowered. The scorpions were already gone. If, that was, they had ever been there at all. They might not have been. His head felt like a haunted house, one filled with hallucinations and false memories instead of ghosts.
Meep! Meep!
He grabbed the phone off the dashboard, pushed the send button, and put it to his ear. He stared out at the wolf as he did it, and the wolf stared back.
Boss? Boss, that you?
Of course it was. Who else would be calling him? Only it wasn't. It was a kid.
Is your name Steve? The kid asked.
Yes. How'd you get the boss's phone? Where?
Never mind that, the kid said. Are you in trouble? You are, aren't you?
Steve opened his mouth. I don't. Closed it again. Outside, the wind screamed around the cab of the Ryder truck. He held the little phone to the side of his face and looked over an oozing lump of buzzard at the wolf. He saw the chunk of statue lying in front of it as well. The crude images of intermingled sex and violence which had filled his mind were fading, but he could remember the power they had exercised over him the way he could remember certain vivid nightmares.
Yeah, he said. I guess you could say that.
Are you in the truck we saw?
If you saw a truck, likely that was us. Yeah. Is my boss with you?
Mr. Marinville's here. He's okay. Are you all right?
I don't know, Steve said. There's a wolf, and he brought this thing. It's like a statue, only...
Cynthia's hand darted into the lower part of his vision and honked the horn. Steve jumped. At the entrance to the cafe parking lot, the wolf jumped, too. Steve could see its muzzle draw back in a snarl, its ears flattened against its skull.
Doesn't like the horn, he thought.
Then another thought came, one of those simple ones that made you want to slam your hand against your forehead, as if to punish your laggard brains.
If it won't get out of the way, I can run the fucker over, can't I?
Yes. Yes, he could. After all, he was the one with the truck. What was that? The kid asked sharply. Then, as if realizing that was the wrong question, why are you doing that?
We've got company. We're trying to get rid of it.
Cynthia honked the horn again. The wolf got to its feet. Its ears were still laid back. It looked pissed, but it also looked confused. When Cynthia honked the horn a third time, Steve put both of his hands over hers and helped. The wolf looked at them a moment longer, its head cocked and its eyes a nasty yellow-green in the glare of the headlights. Then it bent, seized the piece of statuary in its teeth, and disappeared back the way it had come. Steve looked at Cynthia, and she looked back at him. She still looked scared, but she was smiling a little just the same.
Steve?
The voice was faint, dodging in and out of static bursts.
Steve, are you there?
Yes.
Your company?
Gone, for the time being at least. The question is, what do we do next? Any suggestions?
I might have.
Damned if it didn't sound as if maybe he was smiling, too.
What's your name, kid? Steve asked.
5. Behind them, back in the direction of the municipal building, something gave in to the wind and fell over with a huge, loose crash. The sound made Mary wheel around in that direction, but she saw nothing. She was grateful for the mouthful of whiskey Carver had talked her into taking. Without it, that sound, she guessed it might have been some building's false front tumbling into the street, would have had her halfway out of her skin. The boy was still on the phone. The three men were gathered around him. Mary could see how badly Marinville wanted to take the phone back again. She could also see he didn't quite dare.
It'll do you good not to be able to have what you want, Johnny,
she thought, do you a world of good.
I might have, David said, smiling a little. He listened, gave his first name, then turned around so he was facing the Owl's Club. He ducked his head, and when he spoke again, Mary could hardly hear him. A kind of dark wonder passed over her like a dizzy spell. He doesn't want the coyotes across the street to hear what he's saying. I know how crazy that sounds, but it's what he's doing. And do you know something even crazier? I think he's right.
There's an old movie theater, David said in a low voice. It's called the American West. He glanced at Billingsley for confirmation.
Billingsley nodded.
Tell him to go around to the back, he said,
and Mary decided that if she was crazy, at least she wasn't the only one. Billingsley also spoke in a low voice and glanced over his shoulder, once, quickly, as if to make sure the coyotes weren't creeping closer, trying to eavesdrop. After he had made sure they were still on the sidewalk in front of the water and utility building, he turned back to David.
Tell him there's an alley.
David did. As he finished, something apparently occurred to Marinville. He started to grab for the phone, then restrained himself.
Tell him to park the truck away from the theater, he said. The great American novelist also spoke in low tones, and he had one hand up to his mouth, as if he thought there might be a lip-reader or two among the coyotes. If he leaves it in front and Entragian comes back...
David nodded and passed this on as well. Listened as Steve said something else, nodding, the smile resurfacing. Mary's eyes drifted to the coyotes. As she looked at them, she realized an exceedingly perverse thing. If they managed to hide from Entragian long enough to regroup and get out of town, part of her would be sorry. Because, once this was over, she would have to confront the fact of Peter's death. She would have to grieve for him, and for the destruction of the life they had made together. And that was maybe not the worst of it. She would also have to think about all this, try to make some sense of it, and she wasn't sure she could do it. She wasn't sure any of them would be able to do it. Except maybe for David.
Come as fast as you can, he said. There was a faint bleep as he pushed the end button. He collapsed the antenna and handed the phone back to Marinville, who immediately pulled the antenna out again, studied the LED readout, shook his head, and closed the phone up.
How'd you do it, David? Magic?
The kid looked at him as if Marinville were crazy.
God, he said. God, you dope, Mary said, smiling in a way that did not feel familiar to her at all. This wasn't the time to be pulling Marinville's chain, but she simply couldn't resist.
Maybe you should have just told Mr. Marinville's friend to come and pick us up, Ralph said dubiously. That probably would have been the simplest, David.
It's not simple, David replied. Steve will tell you that when they get here.
They? Marinville asked.
David ignored him. He was looking at his father. Also, there's Mom, he said. We're not leaving without her.
What are we going to do about them? Mary asked, and pointed across the street at the coyotes. She could have sworn that they not only saw the gesture, but understood it.
Marinville stepped off the sidewalk and into the street, his long gray hair blowing out and making him look like an Old Testament prophet. The coyotes got to their feet, and the wind brought her the sound of their growls. Marinville had to be hearing them too, but he went on another step or two nevertheless. He half closed his eyes for a moment, not as if the sand was bothering them, but as if he was trying to remember something. Then he clapped his hands together once, sharply. Tack! One of the coyotes lifted its snout and howled. The sound made Mary shudder. Tack, Allah! Tack! The coyotes appeared to move a little closer together, but that was all. Marinville clapped his hands again. Tack! Allah! Tack!
Oh, shit on this. I was never any good at foreign languages anyhow.
He stood looking disgusted and uncertain. That they might attack him, him and his unloaded Mossberg 22, seemed the furthest thing from his mind. David stepped down from the sidewalk. His father grabbed at his collar.
"It's okay, Dad," David said.
Ralph let go, but followed as David went to Marinville. And then the boy said something Mary thought she might remember, even if her mind succeeded in blocking the rest of this out. It was the sort of thing that came back to you in dreams, if nowhere else. "Don't speak to them in the language of the dead, Mr. Marinville." David took another step forward. Now he was alone in the middle of the street, with Ralph and Marinville standing behind him. Mary and Billingsley were behind them, up on the sidewalk. The wind had reached a single high shriek. Mary could feel the dust stinging her cheeks and forehead, but for the time being that seemed far away, unimportant. David put his hands together in front of his mouth, finger to finger, in that child's gesture of prayer. Then he held them out again, palms up, in the direction of the coyotes. "May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face to shine upon you and lift you up and give you peace," he said. "Now get out of here. Take a hike." It was as if a swarm of bees had settled on them. They whirled in a clumsy, jostling mass of snouts and ears and teeth and tails, nipping at one another's flanks and at their own. Then they raced off, yapping and yowling in what sounded like some painful argument. She could hear them, even with the contending shriek of the wind, for a long time. David turned back, surveyed their dumbfounded faces, expressions too large to miss even in the gloom, and smiled a little. He shrugged as if to say, "Well, what are you going to do?" Mary observed that his face was still tinted Irish spring green. He looked like the victim of an inept Halloween makeup job. "Come on," David said. "Let's go." They clustered in the street. "And a little child shall lead them," Marinville said. "So come on, child. Lead." The five of them began trudging north along Main Street toward the American West. Chapter 5 1. "I think that's it," Cynthia pointed out her window. "See it?" Steve, hunched over the wheel and squinting through the blood-smeared windshield, although it was the sand sticking in the blood that was the real problem, nodded. Yes, he could see the old-fashioned marquee, held by rusty chains to the side of a weathered brick building. There was only one letter left on the marquee, a crooked R. He turned left onto the tarmac of the Conoco station. A sign reading, "Best Sig Prices in Town," had fallen over. Sand had piled against the concrete base of the single pump island like a snowdrift. "Where are you going? I thought the kid told you the movie theater." "He also told me not to park the truck near it. He's right, too. That wouldn't..." "Hey, there's a guy in there." Steve brought the truck to a hard stop. There was indeed a guy in the Conoco station's office, rocked back in his chair with his feet on his desk. Except for something in his posture, mostly the awkward way his head was lying over on his neck, he could have been sleeping. "Dead," Cynthia said, and put a hand on Steve's shoulder as he opened his door. "Don't bother. I can tell from here." "We still need a place to hide the truck. If there's room in the garage, I'll open the door. You drive in." There was no need to ask if she could do it. He hadn't forgotten the spiffy way she'd handled the truck out on Highway 50. "Okay, but do it fast." "Believe me," he said. He started to get out, then hesitated. "You are all right, aren't you?" She smiled. It clearly took some effort, but it was a working smile all the same. "For the time being..." "You?" "Smoking." He got out, slammed the door behind him, and hurried across the tarmac to the gas station's office door. He was amazed at how much sand had accumulated already. It was as if the west wind were intent on burying the town. Judging from what he had seen of it so far, that wasn't such a bad idea. There was a tumbleweed caught in the recessed doorway, its skeletal branches rattling. Steve booted it, and it flew away into the night. He turned, saw that Cynthia was now behind the wheel of the truck, and gave her a little salute. She held her fists up in front of her, her face serious and intent, and then popped the thumbs. "Mission Control, we are A-okay." Steve grinned, nodded, and went inside. God, she could be funny. He didn't know if she knew it or not, but she could be. The guy in the office chair needed a spot of burying. Inside the shadow thrown by the bill of his cap, his face was purple, the skin stretched and shiny. It had been stenciled with maybe 2 dozen black marks. Not snake bites, and too small even to be scorpion stings. There was a magazine on the desk. Steve could read the title, Lesbo Sweethearts, upside down. Now something crawled over the edge of the desk and across the naked women on the cover. It was followed by two friends. The three of them reached the edge of the desk and stopped there in a neat line, like soldiers at parade rest. Three more came out from under the desk and scurried across the dirty linoleum floor toward him. Steve took a step backward, set himself, then brought a work boot down, hard. He got two of the three. The other zigged to the right and raced off toward what was probably the bathroom. When Steve looked back at the desk, he saw there were now 8 fellows lined up along the edge, like movie Indians on a ridge. They were brown recluse spiders, also known as fiddleback spiders, because the shape on their backs looked vaguely like a country fiddle. Steve had seen plenty in Texas, had even been stung by one while rooting in his Aunt Betty's woodpile as a boy. Over in Arnett that had been, and it had hurt like a bastard, like an ant bite, only hot. Now he understood why the dead man smelled so spoiled in spite of the dry climate. Aunt Betty had insisted on disinfecting the bite with alcohol immediately, telling him that if you ignored a fiddleback's bite, the flesh around it was apt to start rotting away. It was something in their spit. And if enough of them were to attack a person all at once... Another pair of fiddlebacks appeared, these two crawling out of the dark crease at the center of the gas jockey's stroke book. They joined their pals. 10 now. Looking at him. He knew they were. Another one crawled out of the pump jockey's hair, journeyed down his forehead and nose, over his puffed lips, across his cheek. It was probably on its way to the convention at the edge of the desk, but Steve didn't wait to see. He headed for the garage, turning up his collar as he went. For all he knew, the goddamn garage could be full of them. Recluse spiders like dark places. So be quick. Right? There was a light switch to the left of the door. He turned it. Half a dozen dirty fluorescents buzzed to life above the garage area. There were actually 2 bays, he saw. In one was a pickup, which had been raised on oversized tires and customized into an all-terrain vehicle. Silky blue metal flake paint, the Desert Rover written in red on the driver's side of the cab. The other bay would do for the rider truck, though, if he moved a pile of tires and a recapping machine. He waved to Cynthia, not knowing if she could actually see him or not, and crossed to the tires. He was bending over them when a rat leaped out of the dark hole in the center of the stack and sank its teeth into his shirt. Steve cried out in surprise and revulsion and hit himself in the chest with his right fist, breaking its back. The rat began to wriggle and pedal its back legs in the air, squealing through its clenched teeth, trying to bite him. "Ah, fuck!" Steve screamed. "Ah, fuck, you fuck! Let go, you little fuck!" Not so little, though. It was almost the size of a full-grown cat. Steve leaned forward, bowing so his shirt would bell out. He did this without thinking, any more than he was aware that he was screaming and cursing. Then grabbed the rat's hairless tail and yanked. There was a harsh ripping sound as his shirt tore open, and then the rat was doubling over on the lumpy knuckles of its broken spine, trying to bite his hand. Steve swung it by its tail like a lunatic Tom Sawyer, then let it fly. It zoomed across the garage, a ratsteroid, and smacked into the wall beyond the Desert Rover. It lay still with its clawed feet sticking up. Steve stood watching it, making sure it wasn't going to get up and come at him again. He was shuddering all over, and the noise that came out of his mouth made him sound cold. Bruh. There was a long, tool-littered table to the right of the door. He snatched up a tire iron, holding it by the pry bar end, and kicked over the stack of tires. They rolled like tiddlywinks. Two more rats, smaller ones, ran out, but they wanted no part of him. They sprinted, squeaking, toward the shadowy nether regions of the garage. He couldn't stand the sick rat-blood heat against his skin another second. He tore his shirt the rest of the way open and then pulled it off. He did it one-handed. There was no way he was going to drop the tire iron. "You'll take my tire iron when you pry it from my cold, dead fingers," he thought, and laughed. He was still shuddering. He examined his chest carefully, obsessively, for any break in the skin. There was none. "Lucky," he muttered to himself, as he pulled the recapper over to the wall and then hurried to the garage door. "Lucky. Goddamn lucky. Fucking goddamn rat in the box." He pushed the button by the door, and it began trundling up. He stepped to one side, giving Cynthia room, looking everywhere for rats and spiders and God knew what other nasty surprises. Next to the work table was a gray mechanic's coverall hanging from a nail, and as Cynthia drove the Ryder truck into the garage, engine roaring and lights glaring, Steve began to beat this coverall with the tire iron, working from the legs up like a woman beating a rug, watching to see what might run out of the legs or armholes. Cynthia killed the truck's engine and slid down from the driver's seat. "What you doing? Why'd you take your shirt off? You'll catch your death of cold. The temperature's already started to..." "Rats." He had reached the top of the coverall without spooking any wildlife. Now he started working his way back down again. Better safe than sorry. He kept hearing the sound the rat's spine had made when it broke, kept feeling the rat's tail in his fist. Hot it had been. Hot. "Rats?" She looked around, eyes darting. "And spiders. The spiders are what got the guy in the..." He was suddenly alone. Cynthia, out the open garage door and on the tarmac, standing in the wind and blowing sand with her arms wrapped around her thin shoulders. "Spiders! Ugh, I hate spiders! Worse than snakes!" She sounded pissed, as if the spiders were his fault. "Get out of there!" He decided the coverall was safe. He pulled it off the hook, started to toss the tire iron away, then changed his mind. Holding the coverall draped over one arm, he pushed the button beside the door and then went over to Cynthia. She was right. It was getting cold. The alkali dust stung his bare shoulders and stomach. He began to wriggle his way into the coverall. It was going to be a little baggy in the gut, but better too big than too small, he supposed. "I'm sorry," she said, wincing and holding a hand to the side of her face as the wind gusted, driving a sheet of sand at them. "It's just spiders. Ugh, so bad. I can't..." "What kind?" "You don't want to know." He zipped the coverall up the front, then put an arm around her. "Did you leave anything in the truck?" "My backpack, but I guess I can do without a change of underwear tonight," she said and smiled wanly. "What about your phone?" He patted his left front jeans pocket through the coverall. "Don't leave home without it," he said. Something tickled across the back of his neck, and he slapped at it madly, thinking of the brown recluses lined up so neatly along the edge of the desk, soldiers in some unknown cause out here in nowhere. "What's wrong?" "I'm just a little freaked. Come on, let's go to the movies." "Oh," she said in that prim little no-nonsense voice that just cracked him up. "A date? Yes, thanks." 2. As Tom Billingsley led Mary, the Carvers, and America's greatest living novelist, at least in the novelist's opinion, Down the alley between the American West and the Desperation Feed and Grain, the wind hooted above them like air blown across the mouth of a pop bottle. "Don't use the flashlights," Ralph said.
"Right," Billingsley said, "and watch out here. Garbage cans and a pile of old crap. Lumber, tin cans."
They skirted around the huddle of cans and the pile of scrap lumber. Mary gasped as Marinville took her arm, at first not sure who it was. When she saw the long, somehow theatrical hair, she attempted to pull free. "Spare me the chivalry. I'm doing fine."
"I'm not," he said, holding on. "I don't see for shit at night anymore. It's like being blind."
He sounded different, not humble exactly. She had an idea that John Marinville could no more be humble than some people could sing middle C off a pitch pipe, but at least human. She let him hold on.
"Do you see any coyotes?" Ralph asked her in a low voice.
She resisted an urge to make a smart comeback. At least he hadn't called her ma'am.
"No, but I can barely see my own hand in front of my face."
"They're gone," David said. He sounded completely sure of himself. "At least for now."
"How do you know?" Marinville asked.
David shrugged in the gloom.
"Just do."
And Mary thought they could probably trust him on it. That was how crazy things had gotten. Billingsley led them around the corner. A rickety board fence ran along the back side of the movie theater, leaving a gap of about 4 feet. The old man walked slowly along this path with his hands held out. The others followed in single file. There was no room to double up. Mary was just starting to think Billingsley had gotten them down here on some sort of wild goose chase when he stopped.
"Here we are."
He bent, and Mary saw him pick something up. A crate, it looked like. He put it on top of another one, then stepped up onto the makeshift platform with a wince. He was standing in front of a dirty, frosted glass window. He put his hands on this, the fingers spread like starfish, and pushed. The window slid up.
"It's the ladies," he said. "Watch out, there's a little drop."
He turned around and slid through, looking like a large, wrinkled boy entering the Over the Hill Gang's clubhouse. David followed, then his father. Johnny Marinville went next, first almost falling off the crate platform as he turned around. He really was close to blind in the dark, she thought, and reminded herself never to ride in a car this man was driving. And a motorcycle? Had he really crossed the country on a motorcycle? If so, God must love him a lot more than she ever would. She grabbed him by the back of the belt and steadied him.
"Thanks," he said.
And this time he did sound humble. Then he was wriggling through the window, puffing and grunting, his long hair hanging in his face. Mary took one quick look around, and for a moment she heard ghost voices in the wind. "Didn't you see it?"
"See what?"
"On that sign, that speed limit sign."
"What about it?"
"There was a dead cat on it." Now, standing on the crate, she thought, the people who said those things really are ghosts, because they're dead. Me as much as him. Certainly the Mary Jackson who left on this trip is gone. The person back here behind this old movie house, she's someone new. She passed her gun and flashlight through the window to the hands held up to take them, then turned around and slid easily over the sill and into the ladies. Ralph caught her around the hips and eased her down. David was shining his flashlight around, holding one hand over the top of the lens in a kind of hood. The place had a smell that made her wrinkle her nose. Damp, mildew, booze. There was a carton filled with empty liquor bottles in one corner. In one of the toilet stalls there were 2 large plastic bins filled with beer cans. These had been placed over a hole where, once upon a time, she supposed, there had been an actual toilet. Around the time James Dean died, from the look of the place, she thought. She realized she could use a toilet herself, and that no matter how the place smelled, she was hungry as well. Why not? She hadn't had anything to eat for almost 8 hours. She felt guilty about being hungry when Peter would never eat again, but she supposed the feeling would pass. That was the hell of it when you thought it over. That was the exact hell of it. "Holy shit," Marinville said, pulling his own flashlight out of his shirt and shining it into the beer can repository. "You and your friends must party hardy, Thomas."
"We clean the whole place out once a month," Billingsley said, sounding defensive. "Not like the kids that used to run wild upstairs until the old fire escape finally fell down last winter. We don't pee in the corners, and we don't use drugs either."
Marinville considered the carton of liquor empties. "On top of all that J.W. Dant, a few drugs and you'd probably explode." "Where do you pee, if you don't mind me asking?" Mary said. "Because I could use a little relief in that direction."
"There's a porta-potty across the hall in the men's. The kind they have in sick rooms. We keep that clean, too."
He gave Marinville a complex look, equal parts truculence and timidity. Mary supposed that Marinville was preparing to tee off on Billingsley. She had an idea Billingsley felt it coming, too. And why? Because guys like Marinville needed to establish a pecking order, and the veterinarian was clearly the most peckable person in attendance. "Excuse me," she said. "Might I borrow your flashlight, Johnny?" She held out her hand. He looked at it dubiously, then handed it over. She thanked him and headed for the door.
"Whoa, neat," David said softly, and that stopped her.
The boy had focused his flashlight on one of the few sections of wall where the tiles were still mostly intact. On it, someone had drawn a gloriously rococo fish in various magic marker colors. It was the sort of flippy-tailed, half-mythological beast that one sometimes found disporting atop the wavelets of very old sea maps. Yet there was nothing fearsome or sea monsterish about the fellow swimming on the wall above the broken Towelmaster dispenser. With its blue Betty Boop eyes and red gills and yellow dorsal fin, there was something sweet and exuberant about it. Here in the fetid, booze-smelling dark, the fish was almost miraculous. Only one tile had fallen out of the drawing, eradicating the lower half of the tail. "Mr. Billingsley, did you?"
"Yes, son, yes," he said, sounding both defiant and embarrassed. "I drew it."
He looked at Marinville.
"I was probably drunk at the time."
Mary paused in the doorway, bracing for Marinville's reply. He surprised her.
"I've been known to draw a few drunk fish myself," he said, "with words rather than coloring pens, but I imagine the principle is the same."
"Not bad, Billingsley. But why here? Of all places, why here?"
"Because I like this place," he said with considerable dignity, "especially since the kids cleared out. Not that they ever bothered us much back here. They liked the balcony mostly. I suppose that sounds crazy to you, but I don't much care. It's where I come to be with my friends since I retired and quit the town committee. I look forward to the nights I spend with them. It's just an old movie theater. There's rats and the seats are full of mildew, but so what? It's our business, ain't it? Our own business. Only now I suppose they're all dead. Dick Onslow, Tom Kincaid, Cash Lancaster. My old pals."
He uttered a harsh, startling cry like the caw of a raven. It made her jump. "Mr. Billingsley?" It was David. The old man looked at him. "Do you think he killed everyone in town?"
"That's crazy," Marinville said.
Ralph yanked his arm, as if it were the stop cord on a bus.
"Quiet."
Billingsley was still looking at David and rubbing at the flesh beneath his eyes with his long, crooked fingers.
"I think he may have," he said, and glanced at Marinville again for a moment. "I think he may have at least tried."
"How many people are we talking about?" Ralph asked.
"In desperation? 190? Maybe 200. With the new mine people starting to trickle in, maybe 50 or 60 more. although it's hard to tell how many of them would have been here and how many up to the pit.
The pit? Mary asked.
China pit, the one they're reopening, for the copper.
Don't tell me one man, even a moose like that, went around town and killed 200 people, Marinville said, because, excuse me very much, I don't believe it. I mean, I believe in American enterprise as much as anyone, but that's just nuts.
Well, he might have missed a few on the first pass, Mary said. Didn't you say he ran over a guy when he was bringing you in? Ran him over and killed him?
Marinville turned and favored her with a weighty frown.
I thought you had to take a leak.
I've got good kidneys. He did, didn't he? He ran someone down in the street. You said so.
All right, yeah. Rancourt, he called him. Billy Rancourt. Oh, Jesus. Billingsley closed his eyes.
You knew him? Ralph asked.
Mister, in a town the size of this one, everybody knows everybody. Billy worked at the feed store, cut some hair in his spare time.
All right, yeah. And Trajan ran this Rancourt down in the street. Ran him down like a dog.
Marinville sounded upset, querulous.
I'm willing to accept the idea that Trajan may have killed a lot of people. I know what he's capable of.
Do you? David asked softly, and they all looked at him.
David looked away at the colorful fish floating on the wall.
For one guy to kill hundreds of people, Marinville said, and then quit for a moment, as if he'd temporarily lost his train of thought. Even if he did it at night. I mean, guys.
Maybe it wasn't just him, Mary said. Maybe the buzzards and the coyotes helped.
Marinville tried to push this away. Even in the gloom, she could see him trying, and then gave up.
He sighed and rubbed at one temple, as if it hurt.
Okay. Maybe they did. The ugliest bird in the universe tried to scalp me when he told it to. That I know happened. But still.
It's like the story of the angel of death in Exodus, David said. The Israelites were supposed to put blood on their doortops to show they were the good guys, you know? Only here, he's the angel of death. So why did he pass over us? He could have killed us all just as easy as he killed Pi, or your husband, Mary.
He turned to the old man.
Why didn't he kill you, Mr. Billingsley? If he killed everyone else in town, why didn't he kill you?
Billingsley shrugged. Dunno. I was laying home drunk. He came in the new cruiser, same one I helped pick out, by God, and got me. Stuck me in the back and hauled me off to the Calabozo. I asked him why, what I'd done, but he wouldn't tell me. I begged him. I cried. I didn't know he was crazy. Not then. How could I? He was quiet, but he didn't give any signs that he was crazy. I started to get that idea later, but at first I was just convinced I'd done something bad in a blackout. That I'd been out driving, maybe, and hurt someone. I did something like that once before.
When did he come for you? Mary asked.
Billingsley had to think about it in order to be sure.
Day before yesterday, just before sundown, I was in bed, my head hurting, thinking about getting something for my hangover, an aspirin and a little of the hair of the dog that bit me. He came and got me right out of bed. I didn't have anything on but my underwear shorts. He let me dress, helped me, but he wouldn't let me take a drink even though I was shaking all over, and he wouldn't tell me why he was taking me in.
He paused, still rubbing the flesh beneath his eyes. Mary wished he would stop doing that. It was making her nervous.
Later on, after he had me in a cell, he brought me a hot dinner. He sat at the desk for a little while and said some stuff. That's when I started to think he must be crazy because none of it made sense.
I see holes like eyes, Mary said.
Billingsley nodded. Yeah, like that. My head is full of blackbirds. That's another one I remember, and a lot more I don't. They were like thoughts for the day out of a book written by a crazy person.
Except for being in town to start with, you're just like us, David said, and you don't know why he let you live any more than we do.
I guess that's right.
What happened to you, Mr. Marinville? Marinville told them about how the cop had pulled up behind his bike while he had been whizzing and contemplating the scenery north of the road, and how he had seemed nice at first. "We talked about my books," he said. "I thought he was a fan. I was going to give him a fucking autograph. Pardon my French, David." "Sure. Did cars go by while you were talking? I bet they did." "A few, I guess, and a couple of semis. I didn't really notice."
"But he didn't bother any of them?"
"No.
Just you."
Marinville looked at the boy thoughtfully.
"He picked you out," David persisted.
"Well, maybe. I can't say for sure. Everything seemed Jake until he found the dope."
Mary held her hands up.
Whoa, time out.
Marinville looked at her.
"This dope you had."
"It wasn't mine. Don't go getting that idea. You think I'd try driving cross-country on a Harley with half a pound of grass in my saddlebag? My brains may be fried, but not that fried."
Mary began to giggle. It made her need to pee worse, but she couldn't help it. It was all just too perfect, too wonderfully round.
"Did it have a smile sticker on it?" she asked, giggling harder than ever. She didn't really need an answer to this question, but she wanted it just the same.
"Mr. Smiley Smile?"
"How did you know that?"
Marinville looked astounded. He also looked remarkably like Arlo Guthrie, at least in the glow of the flashlights, and Mary's giggles became little screams of laughter. She realized that if she didn't get to the bathroom soon, she was going to wet her pants.
"Because it came from our trunk," she said, holding her stomach. "It belonged to my sister-in-law. She's a total ding-dong. And Trajan may be crazy, but at least he recycles. Excuse me, I'm about to have an accident."
She hurried across the hall. What she saw when she opened the men's room door made her laugh even harder. Set up like some comic opera throne in the center of the floor was a portable toilet with a canvas bag suspended below the seat in a steel frame. On the wall across from it was another magic marker drawing, obviously from the same hand which had created the fish. This one was of a horse at full gallop. There was orange smoke jetting from its nostrils and a baleful rose-madder glint in its eyes. It appeared to be headed out into an expanse of prairie somewhere east of the sun and west of the wash basins. None of the tiles had fallen out of this wall, but most had buckled, giving the stallion a warped and dreamish look. Outside, the wind howled. As Mary unsnapped her pants and sat down on the cold toilet seat, she suddenly thought of how Peter sometimes put his hand up to his mouth when he laughed, his thumb touching one corner, his first finger touching the other, as if laughter somehow made him vulnerable. And all at once, with no break at all, at least none she could detect, she was crying. How stupid all this was, to be a widow at 35, to be a fugitive in a town full of dead people, to be sitting in the men's room of an abandoned movie theater on a canvas porta-potty, peeing and crying at the same time, pissing and moaning, you might say, and looking at a dim beast on a wall so warped that it seemed to be running underwater. How stupid to be so frightened, and to have grief all but stolen away by her mind's brute determination to survive at any cost. As if Peter had never meant anything anyway, as if he had just been a footnote. How stupid to still feel so hungry. But she was.
"Why is this happening? Why does it have to be me?"
she whispered, and put her face into her hands. 3. If either Steve or Cynthia had had a gun, they probably would have shot her. They were passing Bud's Suds. The neon sign in the window read, "Enjoy our slot hospitality." When the door of the next business up, the laundromat, opened and a woman sprang out. Steve, seeing only a dark shape, drew back the tire iron to hit her.
"No," Cynthia cried, grabbing at his wrist and holding it. "Don't do that." The woman, she had a lot of dark hair and very white skin, but that was all Cynthia could tell at first, grabbed Steve by the shoulders and shoved her face up into his. Cynthia didn't think the laundromat woman ever saw the upraised tire iron at all. "She's going to ask him